50 years ago today, the House of Representatives passed the Civil Rights Act and handed it off to the Senate. This bill made it illegal to discriminate against someone based on race, religion, national origin, or gender.
At the time, this bill was met with a lot of opposition. In the Senate, for example, lawmakers blocked the bill for 54 days with a filibuster. In honor of the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act, the Council on Contemporary Families asked researchers to take a look at how things have changed for the populations affected by this bill. We're talking about women, ethnic and racial minorities, and religious groups.
Here to break down some of the Council's findings on this topic is Stephanie Kuntz. She's a professor of history and family studies at Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's also the director of research for the Council on Contemporary Families. Stephanie, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
So 50 years after the House of Representatives passed the Civil Rights Act, does America look the way supporters of this bill hoped that it would look 50 years on down the road?
Oh, it's been a major change. Back in 1964, it was basically a white Protestant male-dominated country. The religious landscape, the racial landscape, and the relationships between men and women have just been revolutionized in the last 50 years. Take the religion. Back then, it was 70% of Americans were Protestants, most of them mainline Protestants. 25% were Catholic, but they were grandchildren of earlier white European, like Irish. There was almost nobody who didn't identify with one of the main religious traditions. Today, the number of mainline Protestants has been halved. Catholics are still 25% of the population, but mostly because of Latino immigrants. You have 20% of the population that doesn't identify with mainland, with any particular religious tradition. In 20 states, the largest non-Christian religion is Islam. In 13, it's Buddhism. So there's been a tremendous diversification of the religious landscape, a tremendous diversification of the racial landscape. Back then, 85% black, 11% white. Very few immigrants, well, in fact, the lowest number of immigrants in percentage of immigrants in American history, really. Today, 70% of the growth in the workforce in the United States is projected, by 2050, is projected to be Hispanics.
So it is a very different America.
Very different.
And do you put all of that progress that you just delineated down to the Civil Rights Act?
Well, no, not at all. These changes were occurring anyway, were going to occur. The big difference has been, I think, one of the good news since the Civil Rights Act, and I think the Civil Rights Act is not alone. There are lots of factors that created this, but the Civil Rights Act really did make it possible to mount real serious challenges to the kind of discrimination that used to be taken for granted. The gentlemen's agreements that said, and the quotas on Jewish admissions to universities, exclusions of Jews from country clubs, the prejudices, the outright segregation in the South, and the implicit accepted discrimination against blacks in the North, with riots against blacks if they attempted to move into white housing projects. Back in 1964, it was still legal to have help-wanted female, help-wanted male ads, to refuse to hire a woman for a job, to prefer, if she was working at the same job as a man, to favor the man on promotions, to exclude women, to put quotas on them for universities. All these things, the Civil Rights Act gave people a tool to work against. And the changes since then, both from the Act and from the kind of movements that helped actually get the Act passed, have led to a tremendous flowering of real tolerance in America. Now, we found that this tolerance, there's still active discrimination, and there's still also big legacies of discrimination. But really, the atmosphere, I think it's important to stop and celebrate just how big a change there has been. It's no longer respectable to say, as those filibusters did that you talked about, that they were going to fight to the bitter end against any social equality. Nobody would say that today. You can no longer say that women are stupid. Some people can say it, but it's no longer possible to say, I will not hire a woman because as a woman, she's not capable of doing this.
And yet, you found that there's still some work to be done. There's a lot to celebrate, as you just talked about, but are we to the point yet? Probably not, where, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, that you'd be judged by the content of your character rather than the color of your skin or your gender or your religion or some other thing.
No, there are some tremendous problems that we have, and there's two types of them. One is not necessarily outright discrimination, but the historic legacy of discrimination, that women for so long were channeled into occupations that were customarily paid less than men, not because they didn't require the same amount of training or the same amount of skill, but because women were in them. And it turns out that working class jobs are just as segregated today as they were, and as a result, women still earn much lower pay. And in fact, 62% of minimum wage workers are women. Women are much more likely to be poor than men. When we look at the situation of black Americans, yes, there's been tremendous progress for some. Nevertheless, the number of black Americans, 30% of black Americans born between 1985 and 2000, were born into areas where 30% of communities where 30% of the population was poor. When those kind of areas have rotten schools, they have terrible job prospects, they've got very few social support systems, there's much more crime, it's just a very much more difficult place to grow up and to get a good start. Only 1% of white Americans were born into such areas of concentrated poverty. And we also see, for example, that although there are many more black households that earn high wages today, the median wealth of white households is 14 times higher than that of blacks, again, because of the historic legacy. The schools they went to, the houses they bought were less, the inheritance they were able to pass on. But in addition to that, there are outright prejudices, and people, I think, underestimate just how strong those are. We've done controlled experiments where we look at hiring, and women are less likely to be hired than men. When they are hired, they're offered lower starting salaries. Same thing is true for blacks. There was one study that we looked at in a low-income community where whites were twice as likely to be offered a job or a callback even as equally qualified blacks. The only way that a black person had an almost equal chance to be hired as a white person is if the black person had no criminal record and the white person had just been released from prison. Mm.
Well, you talked about how there's a prejudice that exists and that we would be surprised at how much prejudice there is still, either evident to the eye or beneath the surface. And I wonder if this prejudice that you're describing is a prejudice that is sort of part of a historical legacy, or is this sort of new kindled prejudice that is coming up as we move through the times we're in now?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And I think that a lot of it is just the old associations. This goes back way, way. You know, they take these wonderful. Your listeners might want to Google implicit bias and look at these association tests. And it's kind of stunning to see how widespread our sort of biases are that we've inherited. But it takes people a lot longer to associate a female name with a description of somebody as competent or as a surgeon or whatever. And so this is a historical legacy. But I also think that there are people for whom that has been triggered and exacerbated by the very real progress that some blacks and some women have made, which is threatening to them. It triggers those biases. It brings them into the open and more virulently, especially, of course, with the with the sort of accelerator effect that the social media and the internet has made, that allows it people to be much more vicious in terms of expressing their prejudices.
We're talking right now to historian Stephanie Kuntz about the 50th anniversary of the House of Representatives passing the Civil Rights Act.
And we'd like to hear from you about this, too. Are you part of one of the populations affected by the Civil Rights Act? How do you think things have changed in the last half century, either for you or maybe for somebody you know? Do you think we are there yet? Have we reached the fulfillment of what the Civil Rights Act was designed to do? What still needs to be changed? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email at talk@wpr.org.
We're picking up our conversation now with historian Stephanie Kuntz. She's the Director of Research for the Council on Contemporary Families, and she's talking about the Council's new report on how things have changed in the 50 years since the House of Representatives passed the Civil Rights Act.
And we are taking your calls right now. Let us know about your thoughts on the Civil Rights Act 50 years down the road. Do you think we're where we need to be? Have things really changed in the last half century in a way that you can see, that you can touch and feel? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Send an email, talk@wpr.org.
And Stephanie, we'll go right to the phone lines now. We've got Eric joining us in Milwaukee. Hi, Eric.
Hello. Hey, I'd just like to bring up a fact that something I've seen is my stepdad owned a business all through the 80s and 90s. He had a roofing business, and he'd go through a lot of people because a lot of people couldn't handle that kind of work. And he had black friends, and he was a deacon of the church, but he was scared to death to hire a black person to work for him because he was afraid if he had to fire him, like they did a lot of people, that they would say, oh, it's because I'm black, and have retribution against him.
Okay, thank you for your experience there that you shared, Eric. And how about how that did play out for people as they adjusted to the Civil Rights Act, Stephanie?
Well, I think that what we have is a much more complicated situation now, where because of the Civil Rights Act, sometimes it gives people a little leverage, a little maneuvering room. And I'm sure that there are incidents where a person who is incompetent and is fired claims that it's because they're black or because they're woman. On the other hand, we have seen so many very carefully controlled experiments where we actually send out equally qualified candidates, and if they are given black names or female names, they are discriminated against. So these are interesting trade-offs. But one that I found that very interesting, if you look at, for example, the way race and gender interact for black women, there are very many prejudices against black women. They did a fascinating experiment where they took the same face and they put different shades from white to black, and they put it in a game, as she was an avatar. The blacker the face, the fewer strangers interacted or were able, willing to do favors for that woman who looked exactly the same. On the other hand, one of the things that has been found in experiments that occasionally the prejudices against women are very clear. That if you're assertive, it's assertive in a man and it's bitchy in a woman. And yet, black women in careers sometimes find themselves given a little pass on that because the very stereotype of the angry black woman that works against black women so often, in many ways, actually is like, well, okay, the white woman is a bitch, but the black woman's just, your typical angry black woman, and it's not taken so much. So it's become more complicated since 1964, and there are more individual exceptions and contradictions. Nevertheless, racism and sexism still exist, and we need to really recognize that.
Can we talk for a bit about how progress is made? You talked earlier about how the big thing that the Civil Rights Act changed is that if you were discriminated against, if you faced prejudice, you had legal recourse for the first time. The Civil Rights Act is in place now. We've had legal recourse for a long time, people have who needed to use that mechanism. How do we make progress now?
Well, I think we have to remember that we still need such federal oversight and enforcement. One of the things we found when we were doing this summary of what had changed and what had not is that there have been real slippages in school segregation in the 80s and the 90s in districts where federal oversight was withdrawn. We found the same thing when the Supreme Court ruled that women could not could not sue for discrimination if after a certain amount of time had passed, until we got the Lilly Ledbetter Act back, there were real restrictions and some slippage for women in certain segregated occupations. So it's very important to recognize that we still need federal oversight, but that's not enough. We have to continue to work on our being able to work together. Studies of kids show that when you get people working together in a team, teaching each other and learning from each other, that that's one of the best things to decrease both racial and gender discrimination. So we have to work at many levels on this.
Let's go back to the phones now. Tom is joining us from South Beloit in Illinois. Hi, Tom.
Yeah, good afternoon. What I called in, what picked my ears was when you talked about the economic problems of women and minorities. And initially, the unions, the trade unions, wouldn't allow women and minorities in the unions. But once that changed, women and minorities were able to earn the same wages as other as men and other people. And where the backsliding is occurring now is with the demise of the unions, where women and minorities, as well as all the other working people, don't have the protection of the unions. And if you don't have economic power, you don't have any power at all.
Okay, thank you so much for your thoughts, Tom. Stephanie?
Well, I completely agree. I think that what we've seen in the last 30 years, despite progress for blacks and women, is that sometimes that progress has been made not as absolute progress, but just because the less educated, the former unionist white males have been sliding back. They've not been sliding back because of the progress of blacks and women. They've been sliding back because of the attacks on the living standards, the increasing inequality, and the tremendous decline of unionism in America. So that's another of the interesting complications. When in 1964, if you were a white male high school graduate, you automatically earned more than a black college graduate or a female college graduate. That's not true anymore. There's been a real slippage in the kind of privileges that were once given to white males. And one of the things that leads to some of the vitriol we were talking about earlier is that some of the men who have slipped behind blame their slippage on the progress of women and blacks instead of putting the blame where it belongs. And I agree with your caller that a lot of that blame, the fact that your average white male high school graduate earns $4 or less in constant dollars today than he did in 1970, that's not because of blacks and women. It's because of the increasing inequality and decline in real wages in America.
Well, let's talk about that. You said that these prejudices get especially virulent when they come into contact with growing income polarization. How so?
Well, because I think that when people are in trouble, they begin to look for ways that they can, if you're sliding down the ladder, you look for a place to hang on to and another rung to step on. And I think that one of the, I think that human nature can be very, very good. I'm not trying to say that it's all bad. But one of the unpleasant sides of human nature is that when we start to slip, sometimes it's tempting to try to gain our purchase by stepping on somebody else's shoulder. And I think that's the big challenge we have. As 80% of Americans, blacks, whites, men, and women, have been slipping further behind, have had their real wages stagnate or fall in the past 80 years, have experienced increases in economic insecurity, we have to make sure that we don't turn on other people and say, well, at least I should have an advantage over you because you're a woman or because you're a black. And that we have to make sure that we don't blame the slippage on the fact that blacks and women are saying we should all be equal. The whole point is that we should all be rising together equally, not that we should be pulling each other down or pushing somebody else down.
Stephanie, our last minute or so here, what is the most important thing that we need to be working on as a society to advance the intent of the Civil Rights Act?
Well, That's a big question and one that I hope that your listeners will think about for themselves. I don't have any easy answer, but I do think that we have to do what one of your callers suggested, which is understand that we have to look for racial and gender equity, to recognize that that's a potential strength and gives us potential allies, as at the same time as we look for more social and economic equity as well for people of all races and both genders.
Stephanie, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
We've been speaking with Stephanie Kuntz, professor of history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She's also the director of research for the Council on Contemporary Families. She was with us to talk about the council's new report on the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act.